1580 AM Columbus, W224 EG Madison, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Bodies of three hostages killed by Hamas while they were trying to run from a music festival October 7th have been recovered, says the Israeli military. Their bodies taken to Gaza by Hamas. In Tel Aviv, ABC's Marcus Moore.
In a statement, the remaining hostage family is putting pressure on Israel for urgent action to swiftly bring back all our brothers and sisters from their cruel captivity, both living and deceased.
Student protester plans to occupy campus buildings were repelled by police, leading to some scuffles and arrests yesterday at UPenn in Philadelphia and the U of Chicago. U.S. officials have developed specific and highly credible intelligence suggesting that an American citizen who disappeared 7 years ago while traveling in Syria has died, says the man's daughter to the Associated Press. Out fixing about 500,000 power outages in the Houston area, utility crews on what's expected to be a hot day. This is ABC News. A domestic fight led to a six-month-old baby being shot yesterday in Surprise, Arizona, says police spokesman Rick Hernandez.
The woman was able to free herself from the residence. She actually contacted a construction crew here nearby to use their phone to call us.
The baby's expected to survive. Cops are looking for the father. Flash floods from heavy seasonal rains have killed at least 68 people in Afghanistan, says the Taliban. He fought and was wounded in combat in the Korean War. Now, after 73 years and fighting with the U.S. Army to get a Purple Heart Medal, Earl Meyer in St. Peter, Minnesota, finally was notified he'll get it. The award honors service members wounded or killed in combat. An Army review board had rejected Meyer's application several times due to a lack of paperwork, but his daughters, Senator Amy Klobuchar, and others intervened. A federal judge ordered the review board to take another look. Meyer says every once in a while, the shrapnel in his thigh hurts. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. Today we're talking credit scores. I mean, we all know we're supposed to have a good one, but what is a credit score? It's a number rating how likely you are to pay back a loan. Anytime you use credit, you know, like your credit card or a mortgage, the info about what you borrowed and when you paid it gets sent to three credit bureaus, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian. They track every transaction and compile detailed financial information on every single American. I mean, a little creepy, am I right? And they rate you on a scale from 300 to 850. Over 670 is good, and over 800 is excellent. Then the bureaus sell your rating to anybody who's thinking about lending you money, and you get a better or a worse deal based on your score. Best way to keep that score up is pay your bills on time. This is Carrie Joy from Work Money. For more everyday money tips, check out workmoney.org or text MONEY to 88285. Take good care.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. It's getting easier to charge electric vehicles in the Chicago area. Mark Richardson reports.
In the Chicago Area Metropolitan Mayor's Caucus's EV Readiness Program is working with area towns and villages to meet the demands for electric vehicles. State leaders expect there will be 1 million or more EVs on Illinois roads by 2030. Edith Makra with the caucus says local governments receive free technical assistance and training in a variety of critical areas.
So it doesn't come out of left field like, hey, here's a great idea, let's do this. We've thought about this and we have our municipalities aligned and on board.
Makra says EV Ready offers examples of forward-looking policies that make changes in codes to accommodate electric vehicles. The program began in 2022, and the first 12 municipalities completed it in late 2023.
The program provides resources and guidance and encouragement to municipalities to use their own unique strengths and authorities to advance EV adoption and an environment that's supportive for charging infrastructure.
The program, funded by the Power Utility ComEd, offers guidance on updating zoning and building codes, training first responders in dealing with EV fires, and accessing federal and state incentives. Local towns are required to post a website detailing resources for EV owners and aspiring owners.
Communicate to your residents about the incentives that are available through the state or the utility. Communicate to them about where and how to buy an EV, how to locate the EV charger, and then communicate about the participation in EV readiness.
I'm Mark Richardson. Find our 8 trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm Corey Hartman with your forecast. For today, sunshine and highs in the mid-80s. For tonight, partly cloudy, chance of a shower or thunderstorm, a low around 55. On Sunday, mostly sunny, a high of 82. Showers and storms Sunday night, a low around 61. Showers and storms for Monday, with a high near 81.
Currently, 72 degrees.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey everybody, join us as we look back on the news of the weekend and how the Willie Nelson concert was, and your phone calls. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to Mad Radio, WMDX, Madison's home for the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review, and yes, my name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this, the second hour of our Civic Media broadcast this weekend, talking all about the Supreme Court in our first hour, anticipating more of that on this broadcast and certainly other broadcasts of Civic Media in the weeks just ahead as the Supreme Court begins to issue some of these big ticket, the high-priced items, if you will, on its docket coming up for decision in late May into June, maybe into early July as well. About 40 decisions or so yet to be decided. Just this past week, a major decision affirming the capacity of the CFPB to continue to operate as it has in the past, and also telling the state of Louisiana that it can, in fact, proceed in this election, the 2024 election, with its redrawn maps there in the state of Louisiana, establishing two majority black opportunity districts, affirming the rights of all Americans, including especially people of color, to vote in our nation and indeed in the state of Louisiana as well. Other Voting Rights Act coming up for decision, including that case coming out of South Carolina. We will be on top of all of those, as we will the other agency cases, the other cases in which petitioners are attacking legitimacy of our good and decent and hardworking agency officials, our civil servants who do the work of our federal government in the executive branch, sometimes independent agencies as well. All of those cases coming up for decision in the coming weeks. We will be reporting on those and doing analysis of that as well, in that and in all of our discussion, including the discussion that animates our second hour, inviting your questions, especially your inquiries about this reporting, the analysis that we undertake here. That phone number is 844-967-2789. You can call in, you can text us, and you can also drop a note, a text into our feed on the Civic Media app. Be a part of our discussion and ask questions about what it is you're hearing on our broadcast. This hour agenda includes going back into the lower courts, in this case, at least one state court in Manhattan, two federal courts on opposite sides of the nation involving the son of our president, Hunter Biden, and another federal court also in Manhattan. I'm going to talk about all those cases and what's pending right now, the actions of just this past week, and things we can anticipate in the weeks just ahead. Let's begin with something that we have not chatted a lot about on this broadcast, and that is the prosecution based upon a grand jury indictment coming out of the Southern District of New York. This case being prosecuted in New York in the federal court there against Senator Bob Menendez. He is charged in 18 criminal counts by the grand jury, again, returning this grand jury indictment, finding probable cause to believe they'd engaged in various forms of bribery and extortion and wire fraud and obstruction and acting as a foreign agent. All of that pending. That trial just began this past week. Interestingly, in the life of our nation, that trial in the federal court, which is in walking distance, just across the square, if you will, in the federal courthouse from the state courthouse in which Donald Trump is being tried, again, in that state proceeding, that state criminal prosecution, they could almost bump into each other during noontime breaks and other breaks. That is where both of these trials are taking place. This is the federal case against Senator Robert Menendez, and it is a corruption trial. He is a powerful New Jersey Democrat, and this is actually the second time that he has been charged by a federal grand jury with corruption. The grand jury returned an indictment here alleging all these different things, including especially his engagement with foreign nations, acting as a foreign agent for them, speaking directly to the jury during the course of opening statements in the middle of this past week. As this case begins, by the way, it's going to last probably 6 to 8 weeks, perhaps a verdict sometime later this summer, said that Bob Menendez put his power up for sale, trading favors involving Egypt and New Jersey businessmen for gold bars, cash, and a Mercedes-Benz convertible. But it was a lawyer for Menendez himself who pretty much shook the courtroom this past week, piling blame on the senator's wife in all of this. Her name is Nadine Menendez, and the case against her will be tried separately. That case is scheduled for trial again in federal court down the road this summer. The case against the present senator, sitting senator coming out of New Jersey, Senator Bob Menendez, is frankly a fairly dizzying set of accusations. They're complex. They're not easily understood, absent some understanding of what all the cases are about. The accusations against Menendez, filing four rounds of charges that involve a halal meat monopoly, a Qatari sheikh, and the inner workings of the U.S. government, all of that tied into this grand jury indictment, all of it could very easily be confused by the jurors who are now assembled there to hear this case. So as a part of their obligation in the course of opening statements, the prosecutors tried to paint a far simpler view. They said this: the case is about a public official who put greed first, and a public official who put his own interests above the duty of the people, who put his power up for sale. What the jury needs to understand, the government was saying, was that favors were granted by Senator Menendez, including a letter ghostwritten to help Egypt and calling for pressure on important government officials. In exchange for all of that, according to the government prosecutors, the Menendez couple, amassed hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash, bars of gold, and much more, with Mrs. Menendez as a go-between. Now, during the course of their opening statement, the defense painted a very, very different picture, using the first words to the jury to flatly deny any sort of involvement in this criminal conduct, denying that arrangement. The heart of the defense, however, was a fairly stunning proposition, which I've already made reference to. Do not confuse this senator, this defendant, with his wife. The lawyer for Senator Menendez said that Senator Menendez is an American patriot, the son of working-class immigrants who made it to Congress. All of those instances of Menendez purportedly abusing his office to help some foreign power or some New Jersey businessman, they simply showed the senator was doing his job representing the people of New Jersey. None of the things alleged by the government are true. All of that, a part of the initial presentation, going to be a part of an extended trial, will determine during the course of that evidence presented, again, by witnesses, by documents, and all of this to be presented to the jury in that case in federal court in New York City, going on in the past week, and coming up probably for the next 5 to 6 weeks, and then
followed by yet another trial involving Mrs. Menendez herself as the case goes forward. Case has proceeded fairly quickly since the grand jury first returned those charges in September of last year, the fall of last year. And as for the trial, however, as I've indicated, probably no verdict anytime soon, sometime later this summer. The defense has indicated that it will take at least 1 to 2 weeks. It's going to present a defense, and we could have a verdict again sometime later in the summer, maybe sometime around the 4th of July. Except for some odd days off, Senator Menendez will be stuck in a courtroom this whole time, again, significantly depriving the Democrats in the Senate of a voting representative there, where the senators, the Democratic senators, as you know well, control a very narrow 51-49 majority. It is once again a reflection of how these trials having an impact upon the conduct of government, something that Donald Trump is also complaining about in his own trial, which we will talk about in just a few moments. Of course, the difference is Donald Trump is not presently an incumbent of any official position in government. He is maintaining that by virtue of having to be in court in his case, he is prevented from going ahead and campaigning during the present campaign underway now, anticipating the election in November. Bob Menendez on trial now in New York in that federal district court for corruption charges, pointing to his wife as the principal culprit in all of this. That's going to be the defense, in addition to the defense of the senator simply doing his job. Again, a matter for the jury to decide as that case goes forward. Another matter also pending in not one, but two federal courts. This involves Hunter Biden, the son of the president. We know a lot about this. In court filings submitted just this past week, lawyers for Hunter Biden sought to push back the start of the tax evasion trial that's right now scheduled from June 20th into September. The Biden legal team said that the trial would effectively make very difficult for the trial team to prepare for all of these cases because there's another trial set in Delaware to begin on June 3rd. And in that case, the Delaware trial, Hunter Biden is charged with allegedly owning a gun while using drugs. He has pleaded not guilty in both cases. Again, the move, if you will, by the team for Hunter Biden, not too dissimilar from the request being made by Donald Trump for delays in his own trial, but nonetheless has different merits to it. Here, the trial attorney is saying we've got to go ahead with this tax evasion trial on June 20th there in California, while a trial on the gun case is scheduled for June 3rd in Delaware. In both cases, the trial court judges have denied the request and told the trial attorneys that they need to be prepared to go ahead and try these cases. The filing in California came after the U.S. District Court judge there, her name is Mary Ellen Noreika, rejected a request to delay the start of the gun case in Delaware to September, saying she believes that everyone can get done what needs to get done by the trial's start date of June 3rd. So again, we've got these two trials. In June, we've got competing trial dates, June 3rd, June 20th. The judges in both of them rejecting the notion that either one of them has to fall to the other because the attorneys cannot prepare sufficiently. The government, the Department of Justice, which is bringing these cases, prosecuting these cases, maintaining that it can indeed, you've got different trial teams, of course, but it can indeed prosecute both of these cases, one of them again in Delaware, one of them in California. Both of those cases can be handled, according to Department of Justice prosecutors. The judges in both cases on opposite ends of the country agreeing with them, those cases going ahead in the weeks just ahead. More of all of this and review of the Trump trial as Amicus, a Law Review, continues.
You're listening to Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
When you finally find your person, you call the one. The search for a truly extraordinary piece of jewelry that embodies all that they are, it can be difficult. That's why the team at Goodman Jewelers in Madison is the place to call. With an award-winning goldsmith on staff, creating a custom, one-of-a-kind piece of jewelry that reflects every unique detail comes easy. Together, you'll walk through the design process to bring your vision to life. Call 608-257-3644 and trust that Goodman Jewelers will create a treasure you and your loved ones will cherish for generations to come.
Hi, I'm Emily from Weikert Realtors Lake Point in Madison. Your home, your property, your decision. At Weikert Realtors Lake Point, we'll guide you every step of the way, whether you're buying or selling a home or exploring commercial property. Your dream is within reach. You'll find our realtors love what they do, and more importantly, we think it's fun helping our clients achieve their goals. Who wouldn't want to do that every day? Give me a call at 608-721-8002. Weikert Realtors Lake Point, 2045 Atwood Avenue. Find more info at weikert-lakepoint.com.
You're listening to Mad Radio WMDX, home of the John and Gordy Show.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host in these hours on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted to have you be a part of our discussion, our conversation with your inquiries, your questions. Call in at 844-967-2789. Text us. Drop a note in our feed on the Civic Media app. Let us know what you're thinking. Ask me questions about the subject matter, and there is a lot of it this weekend. As always, talking right now about ongoing trials in the federal and state courts of our nation, talking about the beginning just this past week of the federal corruption trial, the prosecution of Senator Bob Menendez coming out of New Jersey. That just underway with opening statements and the first presentations of witnesses just this past week, a trial that will continue not only into the coming month, but probably even beyond that as the wife of Senator Menendez begins her own trial later on in the summer. The defendants in the present case, again, presumed innocent, we should always affirm until proven guilty. And that is the position of Senator Menendez. He maintains that none of this is true. He was acting on behalf of his constituents in New Jersey, did not do any of this. And the extent to which there were any crimes, he says, those were the responsibility. Look to his wife, who will be tried later on. That pending right now in the federal court in Manhattan. Again, as I mentioned, not too far distant from the very place in which Donald Trump across the plaza is being tried right now in a state court there in Manhattan for state violations. We also know that the son of the present president, Hunter Biden, while not going to trial immediately, will be in two different trials now, beginning on June 3rd and June 20th. He is alleged to have engaged in violations of tax law, and then also somewhat separate from that, also violations of gun charges. An indictment returned against him in two different districts, allegedly owning a gun while using drugs and misrepresenting his status at that time. Also significant that as to the gun charge, and also the allegation that he failed to pay about $1.4 million in taxes from 2016 to 2019, Hunter Biden has likewise denied those allegations. He is similarly presumed innocent until, if ever, as the federal government, shows that he is, in fact, guilty of those offense conduct packages as set forth in the indictments, until a jury finds him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, if ever. And again, we presume in this nation, as we always do, that a defendant is, in fact, innocent until proven guilty. And that very, very notion also attends Donald Trump. He, as you well know, based upon our discussions here on this broadcast and certainly in the media across our nation, in this historic trial that continues just this past week and continues into the coming week, Donald Trump on trial, 34 different counts. These are state counts. These are not federal charges. These are allegations that he engaged in state violations of New York law. 11 of those counts involving invoices, 11 of those counts involving checks, 12 of those counts involving registry entries, all of them basically in support of the allegations that Donald Trump, both directly and indirectly, paid off Stormy Daniels to keep her quiet,
prior to and, frankly, a little bit beyond the 2016 election about an affair that they had, allegedly had. He denies that it took place. She maintains, as she testified in recent weeks, that it did happen and that, indeed, the request to her to be quiet was premised upon and advanced by this companion payment to her of $130,000 to keep her quiet, thus the reference to catch and kill, catching that story, killing it so that it will not be a part of the journalism reporting on this, including that by the National Enquirer, also referred to as the hush money trial, hushing her up, if you will, keeping her quiet so that the American public does not know about this in advance of the 2016 election. That's what Alvin Bragg and his prosecutors are alleging in that case. It is at core an allegation of violations of New York financial law, reporting law, and that's what the conviction will be, if any, on any of those counts. But the motive for it, the thing that he is describing through his prosecutors to this jury, is that this really is an election interference case happening right before the 2016 election to change the course of that election by virtue of what has happened. Now, we know well that just this past week, the government's principal witness, not the exclusive witness, but certainly the principal witness, Michael Cohen, taking the stand. Michael Cohen, the one-time fixer and attorney for Donald Trump, on the stand, providing an awful lot of information about conversations that he has had with Donald Trump, with other people, with bankers, with David Pecker, to establish this mechanism through which Stormy Daniels and, yes, other people, including Karen McDougal and this doorman in front of a hotel there in Manhattan, all of them paid off to be quiet about stories that they had that were unflattering, inappropriate, indications that Donald Trump had engaged in inappropriate behavior in advance of the 2016 election. Michael Cohen on the stand providing what I would offer to be compelling testimony that provided some of the glue, some of the tendrils between the witnesses who previously testified and supporting a lot of the documentary evidence that's also a part of the record. Michael Cohen in the same breath, a hugely, hugely attackable witness. We know that Michael Cohen has lied in the past. We know that Michael Cohen has been subject to, and yes, indeed, as a convicted felon, for lying to Congress, for lying to investigators, for engaging in the very kinds of fraud that Donald Trump is now alleged to have engaged in New York. He is subject to a lot of appropriate cross-examination to test his veracity and indeed to test his recollection as well. And that's what we have seen in recent days. And the reporting on this, of course, is graphic and it is meticulous. The defense counsel appropriately, as a part of this process to test the government, to see if it has proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt, cross-examining now Michael Cohen in recent days and continuing on Monday of this coming week, again there in the state courthouse, questioning whether or not Michael Cohen, his credibility is something that the jury should embrace, suggesting that he is a liar with a capital L. He has done it throughout his life. And he's got this proven history of lying for his former boss and in his own behalf. Using multiple text messages, social media posts, the Cohen testimony has been confident from Michael Cohen, but also indicating their reasons not to believe him. Defense counsel also indicated that the motive for Michael Cohen to testify, he resents Donald Trump, wanted to see him convicted in this case in which the ex-president is once again accused of engaging in these financial records violations, hiding this payoff in 2016, that Michael Cohen has motives to lie about all of this. He's a liar, and he is doing this because this is payback time. That's the kind of thing that the cross-examination is all about, to get the jury to disbelieve Michael Cohen. With respect to his core testimony, I would offer that while there is reason to disbelieve him, there's also an awful lot of reason to believe him when it comes to the story, the accounts that he is telling. Why? Because it's corroborated by the other witnesses who have come forward, including the Hope Hickses of the world, including the David Peckers, the attorney, and an awful lot of documents out there, telephone toll records, financial records that establish that this happened, that indeed Michael Cohen was a principal player, but not the exclusive one in it. Nonetheless, the cross-examination of him continues this coming Monday and focuses in part upon a specific set of phone calls that Michael Cohen had with Donald Trump. As we go forward here and talk more about the Michael Cohen testimony here on our weekend broadcast. I'm going to talk about one of the dramatic moments in the entire trial here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Mad Radio WMDX, home of the John and Gordy Show.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Bodies of three hostages killed by Hamas while they were trying to run from a music festival October 7th have been recovered, says the Israeli military. Their bodies taken to Gaza by Hamas. In Tel Aviv, ABC's Marcus Moore.
In a statement, the remaining hostage family is putting pressure on Israel for urgent action to swiftly bring back all our brothers and sisters from their cruel captivity, both living and deceased.
Student protester plans to occupy campus buildings were repelled by police, leading to some scuffles and arrests yesterday at UPenn in Philadelphia and the U of Chicago. U.S. officials have developed specific and highly credible intelligence suggesting that an American citizen who disappeared 7 years ago while traveling in Syria has died, says the man's daughter to the Associated Press. Out fixing about 500,000 power outages in the Houston area, utility crews on what's expected to be a hot day. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Game two of the Brewers and Astros coming up. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The two teams playing at Minute Maid Stadium in Houston, where over 1 million people are without power, millions of dollars of damage after a 100-mile-per-hour windstorm hit the city Thursday night. The Brewers losing last night's game 5-4. They were ahead in the fifth when Freddie Peralta gave up a three-run homer to Jeremy Pena. So the Astros have now won six in a row, four games out of first, as they try and climb to the top of their division and at the same time get some rest for some of their starters, Astros manager Joe Espada.
It's a long stretch of game. We're in the middle of 16 games in a row. We have Thursday off, then we're going to another 13, so I try to map out some days off for some of these guys. I talk to them ahead of schedule, but it's not easy, especially when we're playing well, but it's important for us to have these players healthy for the long haul to get to where we want to get to.
NFL former Packers tight end Robert Tonyan has signed with the Minnesota Vikings. Tonyan spent the last year with the Chicago Bears. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm Corey Hartman with your forecast. For today, sunshine and highs in the mid-80s. For tonight, partly cloudy, chance of a shower or thunderstorm, a low around 55. On Sunday, mostly sunny, a high of 82. Showers and storms Sunday night, a low around 61. Showers and storms for Monday with a high near 81.
Right now, it's 74.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Lazy Oaf Lounge, Madison's East Side place for friends and family to meet for fun and food. Stop in for great daily lunch specials, soups made from scratch, and jaw-dropping burgers, wraps, and sandwiches. Plus Friday fish fry and homemade pizza cooked in a classic stone hearth pizza oven. The Lazy Oaf Lounge, 1617 North Stoughton Road in Madison. Follow them on Facebook or at LazyOafLounge.com.
As a federally licensed broadcast company, this Civic Media station is required by FCC regulations to accept advertising by all qualified candidates for federal office. We also accept ads from state and local candidates. We do screen announcements from issue groups and PACs and exercise discretion in airing announcements with blatantly false claims or outrageous, unfounded statements. These announcements do not necessarily reflect the views of Civic Media, its hosts, or advertisers, and the source of all issue announcements can be found online at our FCC public file.
The John and Gordy Show.
Robin Voss is out there again, you know, getting angry about making pot legal.
Hang on a second, John. I have to pick up this glass ornament. I got it.
That scares the bejesus out of most of the members of my caucus because we know the wrong thing for Wisconsin is to legalize recreational marijuana.
Oh, my God.
Weekday mornings, 6 until 8 on Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX and on the Civic Media app. John Peterson and Gordy Young.
Beginning Monday and every day next week, we'll look at Project 2025.
That's Trump's plan if he becomes president.
Weekday mornings, 6 until 8 on Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for these continuing segments on our weekend show, talking all about the trial of Donald Trump, which continues this coming week in the trial courtroom of Judge Juan Merchan, presiding over this case for the past several trials, or several weeks and days. The trial now including the testimony of Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former lawyer and so-called fixer, focusing upon the cross-examination, an appropriate part of any criminal trial. Cross-examination of Michael Cohen underway this past week and continuing again beginning Monday morning. One of the most dramatic moments during the course of that cross-examination is when counsel for Donald Trump drilled down on a call that Cohen had said he placed to his boss's bodyguard, a fellow named Keith Schiller, who was with Trump on October 24th of 2016. Now, Michael Cohen had previously testified in the week about all sorts of calls he had with Donald Trump, discussing the Stormy Daniels matter, even the Karen McDougal matter, all these kinds of things. And there are telephone toll records that support that, that corroborate that testimony. But as to this particular phone call, one of about five or so altogether, defense counsel focusing in on whether or not Michael Cohen is accurately describing the content of that phone call and whether or not it really was with Donald Trump about the Stormy Daniels matter, or maybe it was about something else. Cohen again had testified earlier this week that the purpose of this particular call, October 14th, 2016, days before the election, was to discuss with Donald Trump the Stormy Daniels matter and the resolution of it. But defense counsel, during the course of this cross-examination, produced a text from Cohen to Schiller, again, separate from the call, before that call, in which Cohen said that he wanted to get help from Schiller in dealing with a 14-year-old who was prank-calling Cohen. Again, not the subject of the Stormy Daniels matter, but this 14-year-old matter, a prank caller. He didn't mention in that text that the conversation was about Stormy Daniels, and the call itself lasted only about 96 seconds. And so that prompts in one of the most stormy, no pun intended, exchanges between Michael Cohen and the defense counsel. Defense counsel says that was a lie. You did not talk to President Trump on that night. You talked to Keith Schiller. You can admit it. And the attorney arguing that it was impossible for Cohen to have had sufficient time to discuss the prank caller matter and then go on to update Donald Trump about the very complicated, complex, serpentine situation involving paying off Stormy Daniels. Cohen insists, he pushed back, he says, I believe I also spoke to President Trump and told him everything regarding the Stormy Daniels matter was being worked on and it's going to be resolved. And the attorney for the defendant then told Cohen, we are not asking for your belief. The jury doesn't want to hear what you think happened. And at that point, the prosecution objected to that kind of back and forth. Judge Juan Merchan sustained an immediate objection from the prosecution to that comment, which is not a question, just a comment, basically a closing argument. But Trump's lawyer had emphatically made that point, clearly made the point. The exchange was significant because it's probably the only one where the prosecution case against Donald Trump suffered a bit of a setback, not huge, however. It may well be that Michael Cohen made a mistake. It may well be that there's some reason to believe that among these five or so calls on this one, his recollection may not be perfect. It may not be clear. And for that reason, it might in fact give one or more jurors some reason to believe that Michael Cohen is not being honest about other matters. I would offer that there is no trial, no criminal trial, often no civil trial that I have had in the 30 or more years that I've done this kind of work, previously for the Department of Justice, now in my own private practice, where a defendant in a criminal setting and where a witness in a civil setting
doesn't make a mistake and doesn't from time to time say something that is subject to appropriate cross-examination, it may well be, as defense counsel has pointed out, that Michael Cohen has gotten it wrong with respect to this singular phone call among the many others that he made. It may well be the timing is not right. We don't know. We don't have a transcript of that phone call. We don't have a recording of that phone call. Michael Cohen maintains that indeed he discussed both this prank caller and the Stormy Daniels matter within 96 seconds. Maybe that's the case. Maybe it isn't. The question is whether or not that is sufficiently significant in the minds of the jurors who are listening to this to discard virtually all of what Michael Cohen is saying, sufficiently important in terms of discrediting him to say that Michael Cohen is once again lying about all of this, which is what we're going to hear undeniably during the course of closing statement. My own view is it is a chink in the armor here, if you will, of the prosecution case, not unseen in many criminal cases. I've experienced that on a regular basis. It does not mean that Michael Cohen was discredited completely. And if anything, it indicates that he is human and may have made a mistake. It will be interesting to see when the case resumes on Monday after the cross-examination is complete. The prosecution has an opportunity to engage in redirect examination of Michael Cohen. The question will be, what do they do to address this particular issue and other general allegations that have come out during the course of the cross-examination that Michael Cohen is a liar? Undeniably, the prosecution will revisit this and present some explanation for Michael Cohen's arguably arithmetic error here. They will ask him to describe, probably in greater detail, what it is he talked to Donald Trump about on this October 24th call. Is it possible you talked about both? And perhaps ask him to reaffirm that, or maybe have him concede that he made a mistake on this particular phone call, but not the others. It will be interesting to see what the prosecution does to address this issue when they have the chance, as they do, to redirect Michael Cohen on all of this, and then the defense has an opportunity to re-cross-examine him on these issues and others. That's a part of our system. It does not, from my perspective, mean that the case against the defendant here, Donald Trump, has fallen apart. Michael Cohen has been resolute in his affirmations about what happened here. He has been corroborated by the other witnesses and corroborated by the telephone toll records, by the documents, the financial pieces, also a part of this meticulously put together case. The government has proven, from my perspective, its case beyond a reasonable doubt. That, of course, not for me to decide or you to decide, but that's where the jurors will decide this case, perhaps as soon as next week. And that leads to the other observations. Once this witness is done, redirect examination, maybe recross examination, maybe redirect examination could go on for a while. Sometime early next week, likely that this witness will leave the stand. And it appears that this is the last prosecution witness. Could be another. But then the question turns to the defense. Will the defense present a case? We don't know. An awful lot of speculation that the defense might present the testimony of at least one other witness, or maybe two witnesses. Those could include Donald Trump. The defendant has a right, if he chooses to do so in our system, to testify in his own defense, to waive, if you will, his Fifth Amendment right to get up on the stand and to explain to the jury in direct examination, and yes, then also in cross-examination, what his response to these charges is, what his response to all the testimony that the jury has heard over the course of the last several weeks. Donald Trump has that option. He has that opportunity. He could choose to pursue it, or he could waive that opportunity, and the case could come to a close shortly after the prosecution's case is done. The prosecution will rest. Judge Merchan will look to the defense and ask if they're presenting any evidence, and that is when counsel for Donald Trump will indicate whether or not the defense is calling any witnesses. As others have indicated, highly unlikely that Donald Trump himself will take the stand for all sorts of reasons, including the suffering, the cross-examination, that he would certainly be required to suffer if indeed he is put back, he is on the stand at his own decision, if he is a part of this trial process as a witness and not simply as a defendant. The defense, of course, has no obligation whatsoever to present any evidence in this case, the burden entirely upon the government. And that will be a part of the closing arguments, which, again, could happen as soon as this coming week. The judge, again, probably taking Wednesday off. It could well be that when we gather together on this broadcast next Saturday, the jury may well have this in their deliberation. They could be in the process of deliberating on whether or not Donald Trump, the first president in our history, former president in our history, to face criminal charges, is guilty or not guilty in this case. It is happening fairly soon, certainly in the next week, maybe going into the following week, a verdict coming up fairly soon. All of that happening in the courts of America, all of that happening again as a part of our analysis here on our weekend broadcast. All of that also including you, questions, comments, inquiries about the subject matter. And indeed, we've got one of our callers on the line right now, Dick, calling in from Madison. Glad to have you with us again this morning, Dick. Your comment, your question as a part of our broadcast.
Well, real quick, and then a question. Seems to be Blame Your Wife Week with Alito, too. Anyhow, when you filled in for Maggie Dunn, I asked you a question about a retrial, and suddenly the show changed over to, and I never heard the answer, to the devil's advocates. But
okay.
I've heard that retrials actually have sometimes real good outcomes for prosecution. I don't know if it's true, and that was my question on Thursday or whenever you filled in.
Great. I remember our conversation. I apologize on behalf of our broadcast here that was cut off and you did not get a chance. We did talk about that, but let's revisit that, Dick, because it's a great question and it's a good part of our civics instruction here on our weekend broadcast. So what are the possibilities when the jury comes back with its verdict? It's really what your question is all about. They can plainly find the defendant guilty of all the counts, some of the counts, none of the counts. They could acquit him, find him not guilty. One of the other things that might happen here, and it prompts your question, is what if the jurors, as to all the counts or even some of the counts, can't reach a verdict? What if 12 people cannot unanimously agree that all 34 counts have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt? Maybe there are all of them, maybe 11, maybe 22 of them. We don't know. But if they come back and say, you know what, Judge, we can convict on these counts, we can't convict on these, we do not have a unanimous decision, what happens then is the judge would initially probably send them back and say, try again. There is a particular name for that instruction. It basically says, go back and do more of that, see if you can reach a verdict. But after a certain time, the judge will declare what's called a mistrial. And that's what you're talking about, Dick. The mistrial basically says that on the counts of conviction, those remain in place, whatever those might be, if there are those counts. But as to the counts that there are no decisions by the jury, no unanimous determinations, those counts have been mistried. And again, it's not to say that somebody did anything wrong. It's just that the jury cannot reach a verdict. And it is up to the government then to decide whether or not it wants to retry the case as to those counts where the jury could not reach a verdict. Very often in the federal system, this is a state court case, the prosecution will make that determination based upon the counts of conviction. And so, for example, if Alvin Bragg here gets convictions on 22 of the 34 counts, unlikely perhaps that he'll come back and say, I'm going to retry those other cases, but he could do that. If, in fact, he gets a hung jury, no verdict on any of the counts, he certainly will. He's already indicated he would do that if that happens. And indeed, you're right, Dick. In most cases, after having tried a case the first time and seeing, if you will, what works and apparently what doesn't work for a jury, the success rate of prosecutions and prosecutors when that happens a second time is even higher than it normally is even in a regular trial. And so your information, your background is pretty much accurate. We'll see what happens here. But if indeed that does happen, Judge Mershon will have a decision to make about declaring a mistrial. The government has a decision to make about whether to retry the case. Again, would have a second opportunity. No double jeopardy problem there. Nothing in violation of the Constitution because the process was not completed. As to counts of conviction, those remain in place. As to counts for which the jury has not decided guilt or innocence, those cases would go forward. Those counts would go forward. And indeed, the prosecution would have the opportunity to re-present the evidence in a new trial, obviously presenting a lot of the same testimony, a lot of the same documents, but perhaps refine. And that's what your question is all about. Based upon lessons learned in the first trial, probably refined, probably made even more responsive to what worked, what didn't work as a part of the prosecution. Of course, the defense gets that opportunity too, and they too would have an opportunity to try the defense case again and do this once again in a second trial. Great question, Dick. So glad to have you a part of our discussion, which continues here on Amicus Law Review as we continue to talk about trials and matters involving jurists in America.
Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected to your local community. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
Did you know Broadfest, the annual Memorial Day weekend event in Madison, is more than 40 years old? The Metcalf family set up a brat tent in their grocery store parking lot to sell some brats to customers. That was 1983. The brat sales support local charities. Now can you guess the total amount raised? We'll have the answer coming up. These days, along with brats, there's something for everyone, including free music. Here's Michael Alexander.
75 bands from all over the country, and roughly 150,000 of our closest and dearest friends each year.
So did you guess? 4 million brats over more than 40 years equals $2.5 million going back into the community to support more than 120 nonprofits. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
You're listening to Mad Radio WMDX, Madison's home for Matt Nair on air.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and this is our final segment of this two-hour weekend broadcast. And in this final segment, as I promised at the start of our initial hour here on our weekend broadcast, we're going to begin our discussion about Associate Justice Samuel Alito, much in the news. We're going to begin with that news story, continue this at the top of our broadcast next weekend as well. Talking about Sam Alito, the general premise here, an awful lot of conduct recently, including something that happened just this past week, but conduct also on the bench in his writings that suggests that this man, an associate justice of the Supreme Court, one of nine, has contempt for the very trappings of the government that he is a part of, is cynical when it comes to the fundamental operations that we talk a lot about here in this broadcast, including juries, including grand juries, prosecutors, judges, doubting the legitimacy of those basic trappings. And indeed, let's begin that discussion, going to be continuing it into our next broadcast next weekend. Let's begin with the big news coming out of Washington, D.C. just this past week, an upside-down flag adopted by many Trump supporters that contest the Biden victory, flew over Sam Alito's front lawn as the Supreme Court was considering an election case. The upside-down flag, the upside-down American flag, aloft on January 17th, 2021. These are images provided by some neighbors of the Associate Justice there in Alexandria, Virginia. Photographs and interviews confirming that this upside-down flag was being flown on a flagpole there in Alexandria at the home of Sam Alito on January 17th, 2021. Alarmed neighbors seeing this snapped some photographs, and those were obtained by the New York Times, and word of the flag, of course, filtered back to the court. And, of course, all of this now a part of our national discussion about why it's important. Why it's important beyond simply the fact that we've got another instance of a Supreme Court justice indicating his bias, indicating the fact that he does, in fact, have this cynicism when it comes to the very things that he is deciding on in his own court. When the flag was up, the court was still contending with whether to hear a 2020 election case, and Justice Alito was ultimately on the losing end of that decision. In the coming weeks, of course, as we know, the other reason why this symbol of contest of the Biden victory in 2020 becomes and remains very important is because in the coming weeks, as we know, the Supreme Court, including Justice Sam Alito, is going to be deciding at least two cases, one of them having to do with immunity, And the other having to do with the applicability of a statute under which Donald Trump and many others were charged in the wake of the January 6th matter. Justice Alito has said in a statement, it was briefly placed by Mrs. Alito in response to neighbors' use of objectionable and personally insulting language on the yard signs. Mrs. Alito was responsible for placing it there. And that, of course, that response is also getting an awful lot of attention, basically saying, I'm not responsible, my wife is responsible. A mantra, if you will, a response that we're seeing a lot. We commented just earlier about the likely defense of Senator Bob Menendez. It's my wife who did that, not me. Now we have a Supreme Court justice who says this symbol of a contest indicating that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump and given to Joe Biden, an upside-down flag hanging at the home, the residence of a sitting Supreme Court justice, briefly placed there by Mrs. Alito in response to neighbors' use of objectionable and personally insulting language on yard signs. Now, we know that there are certain rules and regulations about these kinds of things, even though the United States Supreme Court, as you know well, has failed to put together a code of ethics, a subject we have often talked a lot about on this broadcast and others. But the court has also repeatedly warned its own employees against public displays of partisan views of this sort. Bumper stickers, signs not permitted. According to the court's internal rule book and a 2022 memorandum reiterating this ban on political activism in the public arena. It says this, employees may not engage in partisan political activity. Partisan political activity is political activity relating to elections contested by political parties. For example, and here are the examples, publicly supporting or opposing a partisan political organization or candidate. It says this includes signs, bumper stickers, stating positions on social media. Employees, it goes on to say, may not engage in nonpartisan political activity if the activity could reflect adversely on the dignity or impartiality of the court or if it interferes with official duties. Let me say that once again. Employees may not engage in nonpartisan political activity if the activity could reflect adversely on the dignity or impartiality of the court or if it interferes with official duties. I would offer that language in the requirements of all employees of the Supreme Court, including Justice Samuel Alito, prohibits this from happening. And yet it did. And it's a part of my overall presentation that begins in this broadcast, continues in our next broadcast, about how this is one of a continuing series of indications in writing and orally of the justice's contempt for the very systems, including the rules of the Supreme Court, that he has been sworn to uphold. We have from Minneapolis, Mark calling in. Mark, glad to have you a part of our discussion in our last moments here on our broadcast.
Thanks, Jim. I have a school near my home that flies the flag, and I noticed about a month ago that it was flying upside down. I didn't never seen anything like that before. I called the school, and the clerk told me there was no distress. I looked it up, and they said,
yes,
an upside-down flag is a sign of distress.
Normal circumstances, that's exactly what it means, right? Symbol of emergency or distress, right? First used as a military SOS. Go on, absolutely. So what happened, Mark?
So she said she'd take care of it, and somebody came out and turned the flag right side up. But now I notice the flag is not being displayed. It's a charter school, not a public school. Does the charter school have a requirement to fly a flag and fly it properly?
Mark, fascinating account. Thanks for calling in as we talk about what happened here, an upside-down flag. You're absolutely right. Normally when flags are flown upside down, it is a sign of distress. Not here, unmistakably. Do charter schools have an obligation? The answer is they're private schools. They're private institutions. They do not have an obligation. Many of them do just because, once again, they're part of our nation, right? They're part of the education system. No obligation to do so. And with respect to their particular behavior, not subject to the other kinds of things that we anticipate for public schools and schools that are commissioned by government. Here, with respect to Sam Alito, we've got a public official who is using this flag upside down as a sign, a symbol, even if fleeting, even if put there initially by his spouse, as an indication of some support of a political partisan approach. We'll talk more about that when we come back next week here on Amicus Law Review. Thank you for joining me this weekend and in future weeks as we talk about this and other issues important.
You're listening to Mad Radio WMDX, Madison's home for the Todd Allball Show.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning, we'll visit with State Senate Democratic Leader Dianne Hesselbein about the push to take back the majority thanks to new, fairer maps.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6.
What does cheese, beer, and you have to do with local radio?
I know. It's Todd Allbaugh and the Trick V. Olsen's What Makes Wisconsin Great Tour.
To get out of your own little silo and just listen to folks, you find out Wisconsin is pretty darn great already.
It's great to be from Wisconsin, Todd. It's just such a fantastic place.
Miss them in your town, more visits, and your chance to connect coming up.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and the app. This is your hometown radio, refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. You're listening to Mad Radio.
WMDX 1580 AM Columbus, W224 EG Madison,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.